For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks a lot for listening. And I don't know. I hope you guys like that song. If you were annoyed that it went on for 7 minutes, well, feel bad for me. I like Metallica. I grew up listening to that stuff. That was their last album before it was done. And I hadn't heard that song in forever, so I decided, hey, what the hell, I think I'll just sit here and listen to it. It's my show. Hell, my boss is Shauna and Eric Garris. So I can play whatever I want, man. It's my show. And I got a good one lined up for you today. I'm sure you heard, because it was all over the media, completely drowned out the real important news about, you know, celebrities in trouble and that kind of thing, that a recent British survey has concluded that 1,200,000 Iraqis have been killed since 2003, have died violently since 2003. And in the second hour today, we'll be talking to the Iraqi doctor whose team went around and collected the data for that study. And here in just a couple of minutes, we will have Steve Clemens from the New America Foundation to talk about a new article that he's got in Salon.com, which I think you will be very interested to hear about. But first up, very quickly, let me tell you to go to antiwar.com, thestressblog.com, libertystickers.com, myspace.com/Scott Horton, and scotthortonshow.com, and that's all. So do that. All the bad news. Man, you look at antiwar.com today. Whew. Oh, what a disaster this little Earth is, man, spinning around out here in space. Sometimes I like to think of that Kang and Kodos perspective, you know, people just kind of showing up in the solar system and looking down at us going, what in the hell are these people doing? So, yeah, here's a great example of that. The Democrats' Iraq push on hold, reports the Washington Post. Reid plans spring effort to set June 2008 pullout deadline. And the entire article goes on about poor Harry Reid crying how he just doesn't have the votes to force a timetable, withdrawal deadline, whatever you... And it goes on and on and on. The whole article, it's like 800 and some words, at least. And it goes on and on and on and on about how the Democrats, they want to force a timetable for withdrawal, but they're just working so hard and they just don't have the votes. And of course, nowhere in here is it made clear that the Democrats have the majority, and that if Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi would just refuse to allow the appropriations bills to reach the floor of their respective houses of Congress, the war would be over. The Pentagon has plenty of hundreds of billions of dollars in the pipeline right now to afford withdrawing our troops. But Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi do not represent you. Even though a supermajority of the people of this country are tired of this war and want it over. They have the votes to end the war right now, and they won't. Just so everybody's perfectly clear on that. All right. We will, now let me find a, here we go. No, not that one. How about, yeah, this one. Okay, guys, so this is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas, and we'll be right back with Steve Clemens. We'll be right back. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and introducing Steve Clemens from the New American Foundation. He directs the American Strategies program there, and he writes the extremely influential blog, The Washington Note. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Hey, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
Good to talk to you again, and what a pleasant surprise I got in my email box. If I could... take your perspective, take your word for it. In your analysis of the situation with Iran, I'm very pleased to see what you have written here in Salon.com.
I'm glad somebody liked it. There's a lot of folks taking exception.
There's a couple exceptions I have to take to it probably too. But I like the optimism. There's not too much of it in the, circles of people paying attention to this seeming march to war with Iran, but this thing is called Why Bush Won't Attack Iran. It's on Salon.com right now. Steve, this article starts out with you're at a dinner party, and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Brent Scowcroft are arguing about whether or not Bush will bomb Iran. Can you set the stage for us there?
I can set the stage with the caveat that people should know that I wasn't at the dinner party.
Oh, okay.
I just know all about it.
Okay.
There was a dinner party with Zbigniew Brzezinski, Brent Scowcroft, and it was really a dinner in honor of Benazir Bhutto, who was visiting Washington, D.C. at the time. But one of the points of discussion during the dinner, it was attended by 18 people, was whether or not the policy course that the president had laid out on Iran would lead to bombing Iran or not. And there was a hand vote, and 16 people voted along with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who said that the bombing Iran was highly likely and probable. And two votes opposed, and one of those was Brent Scowcroft, former National Security Advisor to Presidents Ford and George Bush's father. So 16-2, but that was the vignette that I opened this discussion about whether or not George Bush would bomb Iran.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's some important insight to be gained there, that here's Scowcroft and Brzezinski, when they argue about it, they're not of one mind about what the president may or may not do. They both seem to be pretty outside the loop here for a couple of extremely powerful establishment figures.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. And this is a dicey area, because what I'm trying to do, which I wish more people were trying to do, is to look at the tea leaves and analyze carefully what the president is really posturing to do or not. I not only told that story, I told the story of a meeting that I organized at the Aspen Institute last June, last year in 2006, that had people as diverse as George Soros and Joseph Nye, Mitchell Leese, Bob Blackwell, who was the President Bush's former Deputy National Security Advisor, Dov Zakheim, Fareed Zakaria, Stephen Friedman. It was a very diverse politically group of about 24 people. And in that discussion, which I can't attribute any of the comments to anyone, there was a similar kind of diversity. So I started with the point that even very smart analysts are of a different mind, even among, close Republican supporters and members of the Bush administration about what the president might do. So I wanted to affirm that. Mm-hmm. But what I see happening in the climate today is something that's very different than that kind of analytical judgment on whether we would bomb Iran or not. These are more assertions, an assertion by the neoconservative right that we ought to be bombing Iran and get right to it, and we are going to be bombing Iran, but their complaint is how quickly we're going to do it. And then, to some degree, it's really growing in the left, the very deterministic certainty that Bush plans to bomb Iran, that I think is less analytic and more based in fear and maybe more based on the hope of animating a lot of folks who are against Bush's Iraq policy, as I am, or Bush's foreign policy in general, to scare them into action. And I think that's scary because it's forfeiting the third option possibility on Iran. So sorry to go on, but right. I do think that this debate has a serious level and then one that's not, and I was trying to undo the one that's not.
Right. Well, and that's very important. I think I could probably be accused pretty fairly of falling into that second category sometimes.
Not you, Scott. No.
Well, I try very hard to stay on this case because I see the drumbeat of lies just steady every day. They're trying to come up with all these excuses for doing it. And, you know, I know that, you know, as you talk about in your article, there are people in the vice president's office and over at the American Enterprise Institute and so forth who still really want to do this. It's just the question whether Bush wants to do it or not.
That's right.
And
that's a key issue. The last paragraph of my article raises what I truly am worried about, which is the efforts by Cheney on this side, or the efforts by Ahmadinejad and the IDRC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Al-Quds Force, in Iran to trigger what would be a quick escalation, almost a hair-trigger war, hair-trigger conflict, because that could circumvent the decision-making apparatus that would really keep the president from going down this track. And that is the scariest thing, and people need to think about it. This accidental war scenario is something we should worry about, but we should not be asserting that Bush has already decided to go there, unless he has. And I just see too much evidence, in fact, that he has not. It's easy to see in many different dimensions that Bush's posture and what he's put into play would not be the case if he were going to do it. So.
Okay, well, let's talk about this third option then, because I think the first two are Cheney's plan, which is kill them all, and then Rice's plan, which is somehow pressure them through negotiation to cease all uranium enrichment. And that's and they have no choice in that. Basically, that's the bottom line. No centrifuges may spin in Persia, period, is the American position, right? So what's the third
position?
It is position?
Right now, yeah. And it's the position of the UN.
So what's the third way?
Well, the real two options that are facing the president is whether he accepts Iran's nuclear program and intentions, which some people are calling appeasement, or he bombs them and tries to use a military strike to keep Iran from going down that road. A third option is something that lies between them, that's credible, that either creates incentives or disincentives to move Iran from that that alternative. And that third option is what Rice, Gates, the Europeans, Mohammed El-Baradei, and others are really trying to work out. You know, I don't know if that third option, if it's achieved, is going to involve some concession to Iran on allowing a pilot program in enrichment that's smaller than what they're doing now, or what. But that's what folks are trying to hammer out and to keep this high-end brinksmanship from taking us to a real hot war.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, Scott Ritter has said this, and this seems...
Yeah.
I don't really see any evidence to the contrary, I don't think, that he says, look, the nuclear program is simply the excuse. What we're talking about here is regime changes the policy, and if they can't get away with saying it's because of the nuclear program, then they'll say it's because of EFPs in Iraq, or they'll say it's, well, if they've turned over everything they have, well, then they must have a secret program that we don't know about, that the real goal here is regional transformation, and that has not been put aside. That's still the plan. So I wonder how your perspective about the permanent establishment types or the permanent government types, like the State Department professionals and the intelligence professionals stuff, trying to take away Cheney's excuse for war in terms of the nuclear program, how does that fit into the larger view that the nuclear program isn't really what this is about anyway?
Well, you're right. Different parts of the administration have different objectives. Vice President Cheney's national security team, most of the folks at the American Enterprise Institute that are focused on this kind of issue, but I shouldn't blame just AEI, but the general neoconservative wing of the establishment is focused clearly on regime change, not on the more finite and narrow issue of whether or not Iran has a nuclear program. Almost everyone else in the national security bureaucracy of the administration and most of what I would consider to be the sane Democratic foreign policy people have abandoned regime change as their central objective. And so you've got everybody basically lined up, but somewhat disorganized on the effort, focused on how do you move Iran on a course that gets them on sort of a Libya-like track, mm-hmm. out of the international doghouse towards normalization. They want WTO membership. They want technology and investment to develop their natural gas and oil reserves that they can't develop on their own. They have real fundamental economic problems inside Iran that are often not reported. And there's a lot of dissension inside Iran about the brinksmanship that Ahmadinejad has done. So you've got all of that. But what you have is a very focused, very passionate, extremely well-organized and capable crowd with Vice President Cheney as their chief champion, mm-hmm. that's basically very focused on using whatever means and rationale can basically move us into war. And so I do think, you know, it's not like I'm saying, hey, folks, go to sleep. Don't worry about this. There's a lot to worry about because Cheney's team is brilliant, very focused, but they don't have the president. And we have good evidence that they don't have the president on their side that was expressed by one of Deputy's national security advisors admitting in some sessions that I helped bring to light, but which the New York Times confirmed and actually mentioned the individual's name, which I hadn't, mm-hmm. that they're frustrated with Bush and the other policy. They wouldn't be expressing that frustration if the president was with them. And that, I think, is very, very important to know. So that means we still have the ability to influence Bush.
Mm-hmm. And for those not familiar, you're referring to the story that you broke a few months back about Cheney's
right.
and run
and we did a
his
show
lackey
on it,
around to AEI, and then the Times confirming that that was David Wolmser who he had sent.
Yeah.
And now,
and you and I think did a show on that at the Times, so
right,
it should be
right.
in the archives.
And, yeah, that's true. You can listen to that at antiwar.com in the anti-war radio section. And now I'm interested, you brought up the Libya example there. The official narrative about Libya, of course, is that, well, we were going to have to bomb them, but they learned from the example of Iraq that they better not mess with us. But I also read something by Gary Hart in, I think, the New York Times magazine about how Muammar Gaddafi had been trying to kiss up to the United States since 1995 or something, and that the Americans just wouldn't listen to him or accept any of his offers, and they finally decided they would let him try to have a rapprochement with the West, but not until after the Iraq War so that they could say it was because of the Iraq War. But so I just wonder, since you brought that up, whether you
yeah.
think that that's a pretty plausible model for dealing with Iran. I know they did the great peace offer of 2003 where they put pretty much everything on the table, right?
Scott, you're right on target on that. The efforts to bring Libya out of the cold and put them on a different course started far before the invasion of Iraq and was really wrapped around not only Gaddafi's pretensions of doing this, but also the legal efforts around the victims of the Lockerbie bombing, airplane bombing that had been achieved in court, in which this multi-billion-dollar settlement or deal had been charged. And this had to do with Libya's willingness, which was all basically being negotiated and orchestrated before the invasion, that if Libya was able to do something that would give financial relief to the victims of those bombings, that that would be seen as a confidence-building measure that would then take, you know, Libya on a different track. Those negotiations preceded the Iraq invasion, and I know the attorneys that were involved in that preceded it. Mm. But it's also important to recognize that in April and May of 2003, Iran was influenced by our invasion of Iraq. The Iranians made a proposal to the United States to try to deal with all of our outstanding issues of concern with them and they with us, and to initiate a normalization strategy and offer everything from their support of Hezbollah and Hamas and their nuclear program, etc. And at that time, we acted like we did when we, you know, in the way we did in the past with Gaddafi. We walked away from it, said we can call our own shots and determine when we want to do something with Iran. We're high in the saddle and we're victorious in Iraq. So we basically, you know, flipped off the Iranians and said, you know, no later. Today, we're in a weaker position, and our position has hardened, and we're in a weaker position. Iran's position is stronger, and they have a better hand, but mm-hmm. they're less willing to do the kind of deal that they were with us in April and May of 2003. So our arrogance has undone us there. And there's a third country, Syria. After the Iraq invasion, there was an effort by Jack Straw, and I've been told Condi Rice was involved in this as well, to try and offer Syria a Libya-like track out of the doghouse. And it was the fragility of these negotiations, which allegedly the American Prospect magazine said that John Bolton, when he was ambassador to the United Nations, outed these negotiations and wrecked that process with Syria. So here are several countries we have real problems with, and we didn't use our political capital at the time in a way to move these relations in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real tragedy.
And let's not even go down the tangent of how they lied about North Korea enriching uranium so they could break the agreed framework with them.
That's right. I don't have access to classified information, but one of the really disturbing things out there is to see how the success of Chris Hill, the one minor success in the foreign policy portfolio right now, is how some are trying to undermine it with the allegations around this North Korean-Syrian potential collaboration and the Israeli strike against these facilities. So.
Mm-hmm. And, in fact, we'll be talking about a serious nuclear program with Dr. Gordon Prather tomorrow, and I know Joe Cincerone at the Carnegie Endowment has already done
that. Joe's got it right. Joe Cerencioni is has a lot. I had lunch with Kim Dae-jung just by way of a left-field comment here, and I asked him yesterday, the former president of Korea, what he thought of this, and Kim Dae-jung said that as far as he's concerned, he talked with his foreign minister of the current government in South Korea, and so this is the South Korean view, is that there's no merit or veracity at all to the allegations that North Korea was operating in a nuclear capacity with Syria, and that this is an effort by neoconservatives to derail the six-party talks. So whether that's true or not, I can't say. I can say that that's what Kim Dae-jung said yesterday in a meeting I had with him.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad we did go down that tangent about Korea then. That's news right there, breaking on anti-war radio. How do you like that,
yeah,
folks? The former president of South Korea doesn't buy it. Let me ask you this. Over the weekend, the Sunday Telegraph came out, and they said, well, there's a lot of talk about bombing Iran, and there has been. Only up until now, it's all been critics saying, oh, no, they're going to bomb Iran. But now we're here to tell you it's the administration, and they're going to do it. And this is pretty scary. But then I thought, hey, wait a minute. The Telegraph, I wonder if this is just a leak directly from the vice president's office rather than from, you know, people loyal to, say, Gates or Rice or Bush himself.
I can't really say who would be leaking that kind of information. I can say, because I've read the Telegraph articles, I'm not sure I read the one you're mentioning, that there's a big difference between looking at war plans and targeting scenarios and basically having in hand and even seeing some merit and value of leaking some of this material so that you make the Iranian war planners guess what you might do. Now, I know that many people think that that is tantamount to a war and tantamount to a decision. There's a big difference between planning to do something or looking at what you might be able to do. And remember in my piece, I wrote that this is complicated because the president of the United States can't make it look like the military option is completely impossible. It's just in the scenario, you know, you have to make your best guess and look at the various positions and postures of the various actors to try to judge what's going on. In my view, the Telegraph is reporting stuff probably quite credible about Air Force bombing scenarios and different levels, but that doesn't imply at all that this decision has been made. In fact, I have counter evidence, which is, you know, and I'll admit that it's tougher to cite, of just conversations that people have had with the most senior levels of the Defense Department and the intelligence establishment about other kinds of scenarios in the region and how they see other possibilities. And even to the point, I'll give you one idea, even to the point of looking at how you might achieve stability in the region, and this will sound rather crude, and a lot of people will think it's crazy, but how do you establish stability with Iran? Maybe you cultivate, you know, a sort of growing presence of Saudi Arabia in the region. Suppose you cultivate something that looks like a mild cold war between the two powers in a way to help stabilize, you know, what's going on. So there are lots of different scenarios that are being hatched to look at how you confront Iran with something other than what I think will be a very disastrous bombing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But those are plans that the Telegraph hasn't gotten to. But I don't want to knock them for hatching, you know, and releasing what they get. I just think that people need to put it into context and think critically about what they're seeing part of the game, but they're not seeing all of it.
It's funny, you have all the rumor mill up there at the elite levels, and I'm down here on the lowest level of the rumor mill, and I get emails, and I get some going both ways, but I've heard from a couple of different people lately saying that, you know, their cousin or their brother-in-law or their neighbor across the street or whatever is a Navy guy, and he just got back and said that, oh, yeah, all that buildup was just to scare them, that they're not going to do it, et cetera, like that, and I don't mean to put too much stock in it, but then again, the word of mouth inside the military tends to travel pretty fast.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the other thing about the, you know, the military activity is if this thing were to go in a normal buildup. See, the most of the assertions by those folks asserting that we're going to a war with Iran, it's been going on now for quite a while, but it's really picked up lately. You can sort of feel it in the air in Washington, is that those folks are asserting a kind of classic buildup, a predetermined decision to go to war, that the diplomatic activity is fake and it's just a veneer over the real intention to engage in regime change activity going on. Now, I'm disputing that, and we'll see here before long whether, you know, the way I'm reading it is correct or others are incorrect. But I think in that, the military dimension of this is extremely important, and I think you're going to see resignations of generals and lots of others if in a classic build-up strategy, so I don't buy it. But if there is a hair trigger or some assault or U.S. servicemen or a diplomat or someone dies in some sort of, you know, purposely created spark, either by us or by them or by the Israelis or someone else, then it's a different game plan.
Right. And I think, you know, if this is going to happen, I would agree with you that it's like that. In fact, in the Downing Street memo, right, they had option A, massive build-up, right, invasion, you know, premeditated murder kind of thing. Option B, running start. Let's paint up a U-2 spy plane in UN colors and get it shot down, and use that as the excuse and claim Iraq started it, and then we'll just start the war and we'll get our guys over there as fast as we can, but we'll go ahead and get it going. And that seems, well, and this is kind of what you alluded to in your big story from a couple of months back about the end run, that they were looking at either getting Israel to start it. Now it looks like more and more leaks, the great McClatchy newspaper story by Nancy Youssef about Cheney advocating, well, let's hit some Quds Force targets in Iran, let's hit these or those training camps, supposedly, that kind of thing. Just something, anything to get something blown up. And then once they get the war started, it's a matter of escalating from there.
Right. And I think it's very important for people to hear about that, think about it, expose it, expose the players, because I think the moment, if that happens, we ought to hang the folks that are involved and expose it for what it is. It's to get us in an insane course, and to remove from ourselves, from both the Iranian public and the American public and European public and the regions in it, it will really could open up an unbelievable Pandora's box of human tragedy and a real reordering of global affairs that could be very, very harmful to us. And so I think that crisis almost needs to be anticipated or expected and then put in its place.
Right.
Demystify it.
Yep.
And then make the people who engineered it pay for it. I think that's got to be the strategy at this point. So we need to invest in exposing this accidental war scenario exactly for the cynical ploy it is, whether it's Akhmadinejad jobs people doing it or Vice President Cheney's people.
Right. And, of course, you know, bin Laden would be well-served to go ahead and blow something up and try to make it look credibly enough that Iran was behind it for Cheney to seize on it, because, of course, an American war against Iran is exactly what Osama bin Laden and America's real enemies want.
That's right. Or, you know, I have to say it, or, you know, don't put it past bin Laden to make it look like Israel did something inside Iran.
Yeah, for that matter,
so,
yeah. Or,
so,
or vice versa, you know?
Yeah. We shouldn't be living in such a fragile world and a fragile situation where one can light that kind of match,
yeah,
have no fingerprints on it, and then have everybody begin scrambling. You're seeing this kind of activity at a lower level. You know, there was an anti-Syrian politician that was just assassinated in Lebanon. Who knows who did that? Maybe the Syrians did it. Maybe other forces did it. Maybe this gentleman's own faction. We're at a point where minorities are trying to determine outcomes for the majorities in all these countries, whether it's Israel, the United States, Lebanon, and they are trying to use hair trigger actions to pull things off. And, you know, it is a scary time in that. And so you can have majority opinion, you know, pulling one way or the other, but ultimately, there's some very smart folks in these minority political movements that want to reorder things or engage in regime change. And their tactics and what they're planning to do need to be exposed and thought about in serious ways. So that's what I'm hoping the progressive left does a little bit more, rather than just assert that Bush will bomb Iran. If that's the case, we all go home and, you know, just wait for the nasty world that will ensue.
Yeah.
But there's still some work to do.
Well, the loudest voice that I've heard so far in front of the general public calling them out for this plan is Dr. Ron Paul in the Republican debates, saying, you know, right now...
Isn't he doing a good job? it's remarkable.
Isn't it great? He said, look, they're looking for an excuse to bomb Iran. We ought to be talking to them. And, Steve, you know, come on. Nixon went and shook hands with Mao Zedong, but the Republicans can't deal with the Ayatollah Khamenei? I mean, this is ridiculous.
Right. I think that Ron Paul has been doing a great service. I wish he had a real chance to become president. I heard that he was recently up in Pittsburgh, and there were more than 2,500 people up in a small town outside of Pittsburgh, in really a suburb, mm-hmm. out there to meet him. And his message is getting traction in a lot of quarters, and I wish some of the Democrats would pick up some of this. You know, Wes Clark, I have to say, I always give credit to Wes Clark. You know, he's endorsing Hillary now, but, you know, separate from that, I think Wesley Clark was out among the first major Democratic presidential contenders. I hosted him in September of 2005 and was way early and said, we need direct, unfettered talks and negotiations with Iran. And I give him a lot of credit for that. But on the Republican side, I'm so happy to hear someone like Ron Paul making that same case.
Now, Gareth Porter was on the show yesterday. No, mm-hmm. before yesterday. Sorry. And he repeated the story that he wrote in IPS News last week. He has it, and he had written about this earlier in May, that Fallon had said that
the
Iran
the
war...
Force.
I'm sorry?
Was this on the third carrier strike force?
No. Yeah. That was part of it. That Fallon, yeah. Porter had written that Fallon had overruled the third carrier strike force and that he had said that the war with Iran would not happen on his watch. That's what he had reported back in May. And then now he's come out with a new one about the fight between Petraeus and Admiral Fallon, who's for the audience, the head of CENTCOM, Petraeus' boss, that basically Fallon considers Petraeus one of these perfume princes, like Colonel Hackworth used to call him, and this is Chaos Radio, called him a chicken shit little ass kisser or something along those lines. I wonder if you know any speculation or talk about that you hear in D.C., the fight between Fallon and some of the more professional military guys versus the hacks who are just willing to do what the White House wants.
I can't comment on Fallon's comments vis-a-vis Petraeus. I can comment that Fallon has been straight up in telling the president things as he sees them and not automatically signing off on things that the White House has informally asked him to do. That is accurate. I can confirm that other active duty generals and many retired generals, but, you know, this is, not a sophisticated poll, have problems with the position that David Petraeus has put himself in and dislike significantly the political, the willingness of Petraeus to carry George Bush's water on Iraq, that Petraeus is paying a price with his colleagues for what he's doing. Now, there are always generals that play politics. They all play politics. But the political game inside the military establishment is that there's part jealousy, part disdain, part concern about what the precedent is that Petraeus is doing, in part because Bush has been so upfront about it. I mean, in Bush's own comments to Robert Draper, his latest biographer, appeared in the New York Times, Bush actually said, hey, I know that when I go to Congress and I talk to the American public, people are now real skeptical of me, so I've decided Petraeus should be my communicator. Well, Bush is actually saying, I'm using a military general and his reputation and the objectivity that the military has traditionally had and, you know, sort of the general implied trust that many in America have in the military, not everyone, but most folks do, and to use that as Bush's He's admitting that politicization mm-hmm. of Petraeus, and Petraeus allowed himself to step into it. So I can confirm from my own experiences and discussions with active duty generals in discourse that there's real discomfort with that position. I don't think it veers on the level of ad hominem that Fallon has allegedly made about Petraeus, and unless I knew something more about it, I really shouldn't comment on it.
Okay. A few months back when you broke this big story, and I'm sorry, I keep saying a few months back. When was it? In June?
I think it came out in early June. I had the story for a month. It took me a month to develop it. I had the information.
Well, all you do is Google Clemens chain, and it'll come right up, no problem.
Yeah.
And
it was a pretty big story.
Yeah, it was. It'll be your top return. I believe your next blog entry after that was, hey, I just heard from Joe Klein over at Time Magazine, and he wrote that he heard about Bush meeting with the Joint Chiefs, and that they had given him the facts of life. One, don't do the surge. Two, don't bomb Iran. And looks like he didn't listen to him as far as the surge goes, but is there reason to believe that they really got through to him about saying, Mr. President, you know, we're professional generals, and we're telling you that a war with Iran is not in the cards here?
I think that what Joe Klein reports is accurate. Bob Gates is really the new variable that came in, that when Gates came in and has begun to work more methodically, it does not mean that the military option doesn't exist, that you're not going to be pushed in a position. You know, I heard the president of Council on Foreign Relations, the former Bush administration official, Richard Haass, recently say that we haven't even begun to scratch the roster of diplomatic options before us. Mm-hmm. And I think that Bush began to take a different position, and he really empowered Condi Rice and Gates and others to begin synthesizing this. Now, they may fail. Now, there's another thing is if they fail, and this is where Brzezinski, this big Brzezinski, Carter's former national security advisor, someone I greatly respect, believes, is that they're laying a railroad track of brinksmanship and options that's getting our backup into a position that we lose great credibility if we don't eventually, you know, put some military punch at the end of this line. I think we're going to change course somewhere along the way, and hopefully we'll not see that option come about, but it's a possibility. I think it's a low possibility and much lower because I think there's a lot of options out there. But again, you know, this is really inside baseball and inside DC stuff, talking to folks who are it's like the Brzezinski Scowcroft dinner. Very well informed, well connected people see the situation differently. I don't think they all saw the information at the time about how frustrated the Cheney crowd allegedly was, you know, when they saw Wormser's comments. Mm-hmm. Because that tells us something that Bush, you know, if you're playing a good cop, bad cop strategy, and let's say the Cheney wing is the bad cop, you're bad cop because people think the president might be behind you.
Right.
So you're not going to go out and invalidate and say that, oh, by the way, we're angry at the president. We have to end run him because he's not really with us.
Right.
And that's essentially what happened. So that's some of our best evidence that the president is serious. But we also see the efforts on a number of fronts with the UN resolution process. You know, we're not talking a pacifist approach here. We're talking about credible approaches to get Iran to make some alternative choices. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that there's a chance, without being naive, that Iran will make some of these alternative choices. But it'll be a question of how far they go on what they might be willing to do on their enrichment program. I actually think that you could push the Iranians to wind down from the 3,000 centrifuge threshold level to something that might look more like a pilot project that would take 20 years to generate the levels of plutonium for a warhead. Now, people will debate that, think I'm naive, and think it's not a verifiable prospect. But we need smart people to play out those games. I think there's a doable deal with Iran if something like that might be countenanced.
Well, you know, wouldn't Condoleezza Rice in the news just yesterday denouncing El Baradé for striking this great new deal where they're going to come clean on every single thing?
Yeah, they're not too happy with Mohamed El Baradé, but they never are.
I mean,
he was very smart. I mean, but you know what she's not getting, you know, and so I don't know why Condi made the statement she said, because she thinks he's going beyond his brief of what the IAEA is supposed to be doing. But to some degree, El Baradei has set up a trap for Iran, which people aren't seeing. Iran's got to come clean with a number of things about their current plutonium management. And if they provide the information that El Baradei is asking, then we're going to know a lot more. And he'll be able to verify it or not verify it about what Iran's intentions, direction, what, you know, a whole roster of things. And if they don't, then I think it's an indication that Iran really is not there in good faith at all. And then we have a different picture, and then all of us have to look at that and take another look. Maybe I'm wrong on Iran's pliability and where the supreme leader in Iran is. And, you know, but Rafsanjani's ascension recently and others gives us some hope that there's possible alternative scenarios that might involve a little bit less Ahmadinejad saber-rattling and, you know, a more sane view inside Iran.
It also could work the other way, too, couldn't it? And this is the kind of thing that it seems would really angered the Cheney crowd. Gareth Porter explained that under this new deal, if I understand this correctly, under this deal that Alberides made to come clean about all the plutonium management and everything else, like you just said, that if they do that, that the issue of Iran's nuclear program then reverts back to the International Atomic Energy Agency from the UN Security Council.
That's really interesting. That's the first time I've heard that kind of thing. I haven't looked that deeply into it, so I have to plead ignorance here. It's very interesting. I have a hard time imagining that the Security Council, which doesn't have to abide by anything from the IAEA, would allow that to happen. So, but you, what you do open up, I'm assuming, you know, I need to dig into this, is two tracks. And we may not like that second track being opened up, particularly given the fact that Russia and China right now are not supporting our effort to get a third round of resolution, you know, economic sanctions against Iran.
Mm-hmm. And now, the thing is about their plutonium, and I'll have to ask Dr. Prather all about this tomorrow, but I think my understanding is that if they were to try to make nukes out of plutonium, they would have to shut down their reactors for a year and harvest all the plutonium out of their reactor in ways that everyone in the whole world would know about it. There would be no way to do it secretly, and that plutonium bombs are much harder to detonate. You need, you know, the most precise detonation, high explosives in there, and all this kind of thing. And if they are making a nuke, if they're making a nuke out of plutonium, it would be one they bought from the black market somewhere or something. And if they were making it out of uranium, they'd have to kick out the IAEA before they enriched it to a high enough grade to even be able to make a nuke anyway.
Well, I mean, three quick points. One, for Iran to move in that direction, I mean, the best thing for us to do would be to send thousands of inspectors and leave them, you know, change the letter of the law in Iran, which they said that they would be willing to do, to embed those inspectors to prevent that kind of scenario from happening. But, you know, honestly, it can happen because it happened in North Korea. I mean, we have North Korea nuclear warheads that we didn't see develop. So there is an element there which, you know, the critics of this plan could raise legitimately so that they could do it. But alternatively, I think that what you raise is far more important, is that there are many technical and logistical, very complicated hurdles for Iran to yet achieve. What most of the Bomb Iran Now crowd, who's smart, alleges is that running 3,000 centrifuges or more consistently over a long period of time and various other sort of technical thresholds that could be achieved are fundamentally an effort of achieving, you know, through a research and development process, knowledge. That knowledge goes into people, not just systems and things.
Right.
And this is something really overlooked. It's about a technical expertise and the capability of an infrastructure of nuclear engineers who are human beings with families. That would essentially, if you're going to bomb Iran, you're essentially trying to kill 5,000 or 6,000 very smart people, most of whom were educated in Europe or the United States. For this experience, many of whom are our sources for what we do know about Iran's nuclear activities and program. That's very complicated. But what you laid out is Iran is not there yet. And so it is the question of, well, getting them there. And even if they did develop that expertise, that's still a long way from actually warhead development. And it's smart to talk about it because that's true.
Yeah. And now,
but I tell you, if we go bomb Iran and they develop the technical expertise, I can almost guarantee you they'll end up with warheads and be, even if they had a full-fledged and not a fake democracy, you might have a democratically elected, angry government that has warheads that, you know, is even more committed to becoming a declared nuclear power.
Uh-huh. And see, right there you're getting to one of the main points here, is that there is no regime change in Iran. I don't know if anybody's ever regime changed Iran other than the coup in 53, but in terms of a foreign force coming in and invading, if they do try it, to really do this, all they're going to have is the same Ayatollahs, only with a much angrier population on their side.
Right. Well, I think that it ends up consolidating power around those that we would rather not see empowered.
Sure.
You know, but we have a habit sometimes of doing things to empower the bad guys abroad, because that's what keeps our bad guys in power here.
Yeah. Isn't that funny how George Bush and Dick Cheney's approval rating was at 90% when we got attacked? But we can't seem to imagine that that's how it works overseas. I guess our politicians understand how it works, but the people don't, apparently.
Yeah, you're right on target.
Now, real quick here, Steve, you brought up Russia and China in your article and mentioned them here in the show today about the complications to a motivation to bomb Iran that, you know, if you do bomb Iran, Russia and China are still going to exist, and where are they going to be at the end of this relative to our position?
Well, look, I mean, I think there are two things that are very clear. China wants the global status quo so that it can continue to grow its economy and prosper. It wants a lot of resources out there, but it is seeing the United States in a self-destructive spiral that's causing China some real heartache and real stomach ache. Russia is trying to reassert its power in the stage. It is much more a bubble of power, in my view, than real, but nonetheless, its behavior is one where it wants to be recognized as a great power. And it matters. It's on the UN Security Council. What I really worry about is that, I think, I don't have these numbers off, but between Russia and Iran tied together, if you had some deal between them, you have two of the countries with some of the largest, I think, second or third largest oil reserves, undeveloped oil reserves and undeveloped natural gas reserves, a big underscoring of undeveloped. They both need technology and investment and whatnot, but you have between the two of them an enormous geo-energy superpower that dwarfs what is available in undeveloped sectors in other sections of the oil-producing and natural gas-producing world. And China needs that energy. So, you know, one of the consequences, which my colleague Clint Leverett has written about, is if you bomb Iran, you can all of a sudden end up with a new axis of oil. And the axis of oil would be China, Iran, and Russia. And those most dependent upon that oil and natural gas are Europe and Japan. So two of our closest strategic allies in the world would find themselves dependent upon this. And that price may be worth paying something. I don't want to say it's not. I kind of feel it's not. But boy, if the Cheney gang isn't thinking that through, then I really think that they're just beyond irresponsible, because that is a scenario. It's not to say it will happen, but it is a scenario with a significant degree of chance of happening, and that could really reorder power in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I think it's just crazy, the carelessness with which people talk about bombing Iran.
Yeah. Well, what about a Ron Paul foreign policy that says, well, we're leaving the region. Our government is no longer propping up governments in the region. Our government is really no longer concerned who's pumping what petroleum, because, you know, we've studied Hayek and Mises, and we understand that mercantilism is not the way, and it doesn't really matter if it's China and Russia dominating the Middle East. They'll still sell us the oil anyway. Would you be worried?
Part of me, yes. Part of me, no. Part of me really thinks that we need to move along that Ron Paul scenario and get a little bit of this. But I just, you know, realistically, that's not going to happen. There's too much fear about, you know, somebody described, you know, particularly the Gulf states as rich, well-endowed banks surrounded by the worst poverty you could imagine. And in that case, you'll have other states that move in. Now, I just don't think it's in the American DNA at the national level to allow that to happen. But there is a powerful logic to the notion that they've got to sell this oil to somewhere. And why are we worried about it? It's a marketplace thing. Maybe it would help us move to alternatives more quickly. It would get us off of this, you know, this narcotic of cheap energy that it's really not cheap energy at all. It's subsidized by lives and dollars and, you know, carrier strike force groups and, mm-hmm. and the largest defense budget in the world. But, you know, that might, you know, be a very healthy move. But I tell you, until a Ron Paul type is president, I have a very hard time imagining that scenario from happening. That is what the Japanese thought in the first Gulf War, though, I should say. The Japanese, you know, it's one of the reasons why they moved rather slowly in some ways, is they basically said, why do we really care about the Kuwait-Iraq situation? Because, you know, eventually, you know, our basic interest is just buying the oil, and they're all going to continue to sell the oil.
Yeah, and, you know, I only use this because it is the argument from absurdity. But according to Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Bin Laden himself, you know, the devil, has even said, hey, we can't drink it. We'll sell you the oil. So what's your problem?
So, well, that is, I hadn't seen that Bin Laden quote yet, and I like about what half of what Michael Scheuer says, and the other half gives me a lot of heartburn. But
yeah, I think I'm about the same way there.
Yeah,
60-40,
but I think that there's some real truth to that. So, you know, we're all, you know, Washington in this political game is a free trade zone for people influencing, and I'm all for more serious debate and folks that want to make that point, the Ron Paul point. I just think the gambit is that we're not there yet. But in the near term, we got to worry about this accidental war scenario with Iran.
Right. And, you know, I kind of think that the nuclear program at this point serves as sort of the useful kind of backdrop of fear, sort of, you know, everybody picture a mushroom cloud kind of scenario, the word nuclear thrown around here and there. And you know, people can't differentiate between this kind of nuclear plant and that kind of nuclear plant and so forth. If it's a nuclear program, there's probably bombs around there, it sounds like. But I think
a lot of ads reminding people that's what the Bush administration did the first time around on Iraq.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, it really does seem now that it's going to be, you know, six guys got killed by a roadside bomb, and they say, that's it. We assert that Iran was behind this, and we're just not going to take this anymore. And that's been the Joe Lieberman line, of course, in the Imperial Senate, is that they're already at war with us. They're killing our guys in Iraq, and we're just sitting back taking it. And I think that's going to be the pretext, don't you? I mean, if they do
regrettably, I think it's one of the ones that we should worry about, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we just have to keep spending every day on anti-war radio debunking the whole assertion about the EFPs must be coming from Iran, because that isn't true anyway. So
keep up your good work, Scott.
All right. Hey, you too. Steve Clemens, everybody. The blog is The Washington Note. He's the director of the American Strategies Program at the New America Foundation. Thanks very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, everybody. I'm Scott. That was Motorhead. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And I'm trying to call Iraq, and it ain't working. I keep getting the doo-doo-doo, so I'm hitting the area code wrong or something. And I'm trying to, hopefully, I'll hear back from the secretary lady, and she'll give me the number correctly this time. And then it'll be great. Perhaps, maybe, talk to Dr. Daghir, which I'm probably pronouncing incorrectly. I really don't know what to make of this, y'all, this million. Sounds believable to me. What do you think? A million dead in 4.5 years in Iraq? Other than dying of disease and old age, that doesn't count. Even though you should probably count all the cholera and dysentery and the rest of it. A million people, that's what this survey says. It's opinion.co.uk. That's pretty easy, right? Opinion.co.uk. The Opinion Research Business, it's called. And as Lou Rockwell pointed out in his article yesterday, none dare call it genocide. This is a survey group that is often cited by the White House and the Pentagon when the numbers go their way. So I don't know if that means that they're credible or not. Of course, random samples, science, I don't know. They went around, they said they excluded Anbar province, too dangerous. Seems like you would have higher casualty rates there, considering the two merciless attacks on Fallujah and all the infighting. Suicide bombing. Number here is 646-6446. 646-6446-512 if you're calling from out of town to get to Austin, Texas. 512-646-6446. Happy to take y'all's calls. And then hopefully here, I'm waiting on an email. Hopefully I'll get the correct number to get the good doctor on the phone to discuss his research. And if not, we'll try again tomorrow. As I said, Dr. Prather will be on the show tomorrow to discuss Syria's nuclear program, which is, you know, about as advanced as, what a kid can make in his basement. Has nothing to do with weapons whatsoever and couldn't possibly, but anyway. We'll be discussing that with nuclear physicist Gordon Prather tomorrow, and hopefully we will, if we can't get it done today, hopefully we'll get a chance to talk with the guys from the Opinion Research Business in Great Britain. There was a study that came out last year, shortly before the election, almost 1 year ago, from Johns Hopkins University and the Lancet Medical Journal in England. And in this study, they found that their best guess was that 655,000 Iraqis had been killed. 655,000. And the footwork for that was done last July. So it's been more than a year, if their calculations were correct then. And I don't think there's any doubt that there's thousands of people dying in Iraq every month. That's at least, 3,000, somewhere around 3,000 people a month. I don't know. Maybe more than that. Probably, I don't know what you're supposed to do with the official government numbers that they give us, double them or triple them or what. But in this study, apparently they went around and asked people, how many people in your household, how many people who lived here have died violently since 2003? And be specific. And they went around and they got what seemed like a pretty good sample. I forgot. I'm not looking right at the study. Should have prepared for today's show a little better. Maybe it's a good thing I didn't have proper phone number to get a hold of this guy. But I could have just asked him, right? And then it would have been fine. They went around and got, you know, some sort of pretty large sample of Iraqis, and they extrapolated that over 1 million Iraqis have died violently. Hey, let me ask you something. How many times has the following phrase escaped your lips? Well, the Iraqi people are a lot better off now. How many times have you said that? Well, I'm sure the Iraqi people are much better off. Never mind that super majorities of them in polls have disagreed with that for the last 4 years. Never mind that. Never mind that the Iraqi people don't think that they're better off. Oh no, I'm pretty sure the Iraqi people are better off. After all, in, you know, 25 years in power, Saddam Hussein killed 300,000 of them. And of course, the first 100,000 was with American help. Second 100,000, I guess, was his, you know, own personal problems. Of course, the CIA supplied the Baathists with all the lists of people who were to be murdered because they knew how to read or, you know, whatever their problem was. You know, the CIA as the Khmer Rouge. Don't you love that? Here's a list of people who went to school. Go and get them. Yeah, they're all Reds. Go get them. And then, of course, you had George Bush Sr.'s magnificent Bay of Pigs-style betrayal of the Shia and Kurdish uprising in 1991. Were they accidentally in the negotiations where America could have anything they wanted, let Saddam Hussein keep his attack helicopters? And then Bush went on TV and said, people of Iraq, rise up, overthrow Saddam Hussein, we'll support you. And they did. And I forget, I think it was they actually had control of 14 out of 19 provinces at one point. And then came Saddam Hussein's attack helicopters and his army under their protection wiped out 100,000 people. As Americans stood right there and watched, you've seen the movie Three Kings. The Americans stand right there occupying southern Iraq, watching the Baathists brutalize and massacre the Shiite uprising that the president had encouraged. Oh, but they're a lot better off now. The fact that Saddam Hussein killed about 300,000 of them, and that was pretty much all the American government's fault in the first place. You know, never mind that. That's notwithstanding, you see. And the fact, the fact? Question mark? In italics? I don't know. The story now that 1 million, perhaps 1,200,000 Iraqis have died violently since 2003. Well, I'll just keep that on the right half of my brain, and then in the left half of my brain, I'll repeat the mantra that I'm sure the Iraqi people are a lot better off now than they were under Saddam Hussein. When Iraq was, as Lou Rockwell again pointed out in his article, None Dare Call It Genocide, yesterday on LouRockwell.com, it was the most westernized Arab country. Women could drive cars and they could teach college, not just, you know, attend them. Religious minorities were protected. You know, I think it was the first interview I did with Scott Ritter. Well, maybe the second one. Back in 2005. We talked about how in his book Endgame, he describes Saddam Hussein not as Hitler, but as Tony Soprano. He's a mob boss. And he says, all right, look, you and you, your tribe, your sect and your clan and whatever, you guys share this business and you guys share this business and you have your daughter marry this guy And we'll keep everything on an even keel as best we can. That's who Saddam Hussein was, a vicious gangster. A tin pot dictator whose job it was to forge compromises between all the competing factions in his country so that he could maintain his power. And the Mandians and the Assyrian Christians and the Yazidis and the Turkmen and all the different ethnic and religious factions in Iraq that I've never even heard of and you've never even heard of, they were protected by the Ba'athists, which was a secular fascist government that, you know, it was, you might remember, installed by the West in the first place. And now a million of them are dead just since 2003. And that's the death rate. That's the people who died violently. Never mind the cholera and the dysentery and the people who died on the way to the hospital who otherwise would have made it, but there were 15 armed roadblocks between them and the hospital, or there was a curfew in the middle of the night. And on and on and on. It's funny. It's like, I think from the American living room perspective, maybe even including my own, this is all just some bad dream that will be over soon, someday. George Bush will be gone someday. But you know, this is the history of the world being written here, folks. Remember that time America killed a million Iraqis? Remember when they made the Hutu massacre of the Tutsis in Rwanda look like nothing? I mean, this is the kind of shit that Bibles are written about. This is going to be the history of the world from here on out. When America came and destroyed Mesopotamia. And I'll go ahead and get into the argument, because it needs to be one, and somehow it's not one yet. The American invasion destroyed that country. The occupation has done nothing but make it worse and worse and worse this whole time. Our presence is not helping things there, our presence. The presence of the people who joined the military and are over there serving at the orders of our government, which is, of course, not our country and not our, you know, us, we, the people, garbage. Hang on, I don't like this cigarette. Making things worse. Worse. See, in the headlines, Turkey debates, just how much they'll take from the PKK before they invade and crush a nascent Kurdish rebellion against Turkish domination. That's just one billion zillion dollar arms deals to all the Islamo-fascist American puppet dictators like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Oman, Egypt, etc. The guys who are financing the so-called insurgency, I guess they're our heroes now, the terrorists and the dead-enders. Now they're the good guys. It's amazing how quick that backstab comes. And I think Justin Raimondo is right in his new article where he says that the destruction of Iraq was on purpose. That, you know, as far as coming up with nation-building plans, there are some that are more effective than others. You know, Bartlett and Steele have a new one in Vanity Fair where they explain that, adjusted for inflation, the occupation of Iraq and the so-called reconstruction of Iraq, I think, actually is the only number they're talking about, so-called reconstruction of Iraq was three times what was spent rebuilding Japan, which is much larger, heavily industrialized, adjusted for inflation, and there's been a lot of inflation since 1945, my friends. Adjusted for inflation, we've paid for three rebuildings of Japan in Iraq. I need to try again to get Bartlett and Steele on my show to talk about that article. It's in Vanity Fair. Where did all those missing billions go? Ah, gee, there is a giant pallet of cash right here. I don't know where it went. I swear it was just right there. Oh, man. Yeah, the rape and butchery murder of Iraq and the fleecing of the American people. How many trillions is this thing going to cost before it's over? Before our enduring relationship with Iraq finally comes to an end? I wonder why they call it that, enduring. Enduring what? All opposition? All time? What is right? Is it just because it sort of sounds like endearing? As though the Iraqis just love having their country permanently colonialized and occupied by foreigners? Yes, these are endearing bases. How would you like it if some Arabs came and built military bases all over Texas? And drove around on patrol killing your neighbors? Your family members. Would you or would you not join the local right-wing militia? Boy, it's so difficult to understand, isn't it? Huh. Like we were Iraq and they were us. And a bunch of Arabs came and destroyed our civilization and murdered us by the millions. I guess we might be angry. We might have something to fight about. There's an article on LouRockwell.com today by a soldier serving in Anbar province called, well, let me get the title exactly right if I can find it here. I think the title was, here it is. What Terrorists? Philip Martin, a Marine in Iraq, on the misuse of language. He says, call them what you will. Don't call them terrorists. They're Iraqis. We're occupiers. They're shooting at us. He's a Marine in Anbar province. And says, hey, look, I'm doing my job, but let's get this straight. Some guy defending his property from a foreign invading force is not a terrorist, all right? And if words mean things, then let's use them to mean the things we're talking about instead of using them to lie. My favorite Bill Hicks quotes. Let's not mince words. Our very life depends upon truth. George Michaels is a big girl, I think was the end of that old 80s pop star. Sorry, outdated joke for you kiddies. You wouldn't understand. Oh, God. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm going to play a song for you here if I can find one. And then I'll come back and maybe take y'all's calls. If anybody wants to call in the show, it's 512-646-6446. We'll be right back. Anti-War Radio, Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin. I'm Scott. Hey, call in the show, why don't you? It's 512-646-6446. You guys hate the government, right? I do. Hey, maybe you love government and you want to call to defend its greatness and honor. You could do that too if you want. Gotta protect our honor by murdering people. Because that's how to protect honor. Learn that in government school. You know, when someone says to me the word Democrat, you know what I see in my mind's eye? I see John Kerry standing there with his hand in his pocket saying not a word. As four or five cops beat the crap out of and electrocute some kid for asking him a question. And you know, Donald Rumsfeld, who is a war criminal and who, as I've said many times, deserves to be indicted by a grand jury, convicted by a petit jury, have all his appeals exhausted, and then be hung from a rope for being a war criminal, mass murderer, disgrace to all of humankind. When Ray McGovern confronted Don Rumsfeld and said, "Why did you say that you knew where the weapons were? That was a lie." And Don Rumsfeld said, "I never said that I knew where the weapons were." And Ray McGovern said, "Yes, you did. You said they were north, south, east, and west somewhat from Baghdad into Crit. That's what you told George Stephanopoulos on ABC this week, Sunday morning." And Don Rumsfeld said, "Hey, look, those soldiers didn't dress up in mop gear for no reason." And then, of course, you know, the obvious answer to that is, "Yeah, that's because you were lying to them, too. You were their boss, liar." But during that exchange between Ray McGovern and Don Rumsfeld, some security goons came up. This isn't America. You knew that the book X America was published 50 years ago, right? Was it 60 now? Okay, good. The security goons came up to grab Ray McGovern and His Imperial Majesty, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, told the security goons, hey, hands off that guy. Let him ask his question. I ain't scared, right? It wasn't because he has any respect for Ray McGovern's rights. It's only because he has to pretend, he wanted to pretend to that audience, that he's not scared of some old man asking him a question. And he told the security guys, hey, hands off. Let him speak. And the security goons said, oh, okay, whatever you say, Your Imperial Highness. And they didn't drag Ray McGovern out of there. Actually, now that I think about it, maybe they dragged him out at the end when he was done with his question. I forget. But in any case, when Don Rumsfeld was on the stage and told the security droids, stop it, they stopped. Now, this kid at the University of Florida, after John Kerry's speech, gets up and says, "I have a couple of questions. I'll hold here in my hand, sir, a copy of Armed Madhouse by Greg Palast. Are you familiar with this book, Mr. Kerry?" And John Kerry said, "Yes, I am. I own that book. I've read it." And the kid says, "Well, good. You know, in this book, Greg Palast reports that 5 million votes were suppressed in the election of 2004. And quite a bit of that, particularly in Ohio. And yet, you conceded the election that day. Why?" "And I got another question." "Wait, don't answer that yet. I have another question," he said. "You say you're opposed to war with Iran. Why don't you then remove the president from power? You say that you're concerned George Bush is going to start a war. Well, you're one of the leaders of the Imperial Senate, pal. Why do you not remove him from power? And I have a third question. Isn't it true that you guys are Skull and Bones bunkmates?" And before John Kerry could answer any of these pointed questions, I like the first two. Although, like, I'd have preferred Kerry in 04. Whatever. I guess this kid probably wouldn't either at this point. I really like the second question. If you're so opposed to war with Iran and you're so worried that they're going to see some pretext and have one, you should remove them from power. That's your job. You're a senator in the majority. Guess John Kerry's never read the Constitution. Doesn't realize. But anyway, so before John, I am a war criminal, Kerry, had a chance to answer, the security droids tackled this kid, dragged him, you know, kind of up the aisle there. What, five or six of them, all with their knees on him. And then they tasered him, and they didn't just taser him, they tasered him. And of course, the kid was a loudmouth left winger complainy guy or whatever, and so maybe you watched the YouTube and you decided you didn't like that kid or something like that. But I have to tell you this. I was raised, and my folks ain't naive either, but I was raised to believe that that's the kind of thing that does not happen in the United States. And not just because we have a First Amendment, but because we believe in it. We mean it. Presidential candidate gives a speech, holds a question and answer session. You ought to be able to ask him a question without being beaten and electrocuted. And I don't think I'm being an extremist in saying so. But apparently none of this is out of the ordinary to John Kerry, because he just stands there and doesn't say anything. I guess when they first tried to grab him, he said, no, let him ask. But when the kid was done with his questions, oh, you want to ask me about Skull and Bones, huh? Yeah, off with his head. And away they take him. And John Kerry, I love the first shot of it I saw, and there's of course six different angles of this thing you can watch on YouTube or whatever. But the first angle of this footage that I saw, there he is in the background, kind of far away, out of focus. There's John Kerry, standing holding the mic in one hand, with his other hand in his pocket. Just standing there. He could call off the security droids with a single word, and declines the opportunity. As this kid is beaten for asking a question. Now, let me go ahead and be clear and be specific here, okay? It is not okay for you to kidnap John Kerry and take him to your basement and tie him up like that movie Misery and force him to answer all your questions. Okay? You can't do that. That's not free speech. Right? But you're a university student at a university. You sat through, what, 2 hours of John Kerry talking? Is that what they said? God, that's got to be worse than listening to this show. And then it's time for questions and answers. They pass you a microphone. Be careful, you're taking your life, or you're putting your life into the state's hands at this point. Unless your question is, John Kerry, can you please expound upon your greatness for us? What a disgrace. And then I have to turn on CNN and I have to hear the spin on the news is, isn't this some funny footage? Look at here. Yeah, cops, if you're going to beat and taser guy, you probably shouldn't do it when there's 10 video cameras pointed at you. Back to you, Janie. As though this isn't an outrage. And by the way, how many of your neighbors have been murdered by cops with tasers lately? Do you even know? I lost count. I quit trying to count. I just read one on the Lou Rockwell blog today. Schizophrenic lady in a wheelchair. Bound to a wheelchair. The cops were called by her family. That's always a really good idea, to call the government on your family members, you stupids. Calls the cops because the schizophrenic woman in the wheelchair has got a knife and is freaking everybody out. The cops come and taser her to death in her own home. Just the other day. It's on Lou Rockwell's blog right now. And maybe this wasn't just the other day, because actually it said in there the conclusion was the cops were found not guilty of whatever. They weren't prosecuted. They were cleared of all wrongdoing, as is always the case. Same thing as the footage of the young black girl working the drive-thru, and the cop falsely concludes somehow that she shortchanged him, who comes in and beats her and maces her in the face over it. It's funny, on the footage that I saw that, I hope you people have seen that, you can Google it pretty easily. On the clip of it I saw, it was a clip off of the Max X hilarious video footage of crazy shit. And the conclusion was, the officer was cleared of all wrongdoing, the girl was awarded $60,000. Well, pardon my cognitive dissonance here. If he didn't do anything wrong, then she didn't deserve $60,000. Ipso facto. Right? No, the answer is, he did do wrong to her. He beat an underage girl and sprayed her face with chemical weapons, which she choked and had to go to the hospital, by the way. So no, that's not my hyperbole. Could have killed her. And was cleared of all charges. And it makes me wonder, how many people has Officer McDonald killed since then? That was his name, I think, McDonald. And yeah, anyway, I'm just, you know, here's my thing. I remember being a kid and people saying, hey, America, the reason we have this Cold War thing with the Soviet Union is because, man, they got a really bad system over there where the government owns you, where they make believe like they created you. And they'll decide, womb to tomb, your life is theirs. And here in America, it's not like that. Here in America, we're free. Here in America, we got the red, white, and blue. And we'll protect the world forever from those dastardly collectivists who want to steal your right to determine your own destiny away. And now look at us. Where's the difference? I'm trying to find the difference between America and the Soviet Union, and it's getting more difficult, and it ain't just the foreign policy. Yeah, John Kerry. What a guy. Oh, some security droids are tasering a kid for nothing but asking me a question in, you know, perhaps a bit overzealous voice. I'm sure the kid's nervous. He's asking a question of a former presidential candidate, a member of the Imperial Senate in high standing. It's an intimidating thing. And so the kid was kind of, he was going off. He was loud. But his questions were more or less concise. He didn't make a move toward the former presidential candidate. And what does John Kerry do? John Kerry just stands there. So what does that make him? What does that make the rest of the people in the crowd? I have to admit, I was pretty shocked to see the people in the crowd do nothing but stand around filming it. And I can understand their hesitation. These cops are armed. These cops will kill you and will be cleared of all wrongdoing. But it seemed like the kind of situation where a mob of students should have taken the guns from those cops and held them at gunpoint and said, no, you're under arrest. And you get your fucking hands off of him. And see, that's the thing. It's not that they had overwhelming force. There were only six of them. And those students could have put a stop to that real quick, and they didn't. And since they're students, I'll have to assume they've read something somewhere before. Some of them must know that people die from these police tasers all the time, as these cops are sadistically holding this taser to the guy's ribs. And who defended him? No one. And now here's the thing. Don't get me wrong, because, well, hey, if you get arrested, chances are you're going to have a phone call and a lawyer, and you'll be bonded out, and you'll get some sort of trial in front of a judicial branch thing. As long as that's the case, you probably don't want to lose your life resisting arrest. That's fair enough, right? I can understand the risk-benefit analysis going on in the minds of these people. Well, I have a video camera, and I'm definitely going to put these pigs on TV. But am I going to go over there and start Muay Thai kicking the crap out of them? And risk losing my life today? I can see why people would be hesitant. But then again, they could have killed that guy. And the students outnumbered the cops by, I don't know, 10 to 1? More than that. I guess I can't talk too much shit. I walked in on a Quickie Mart being robbed, and I ran the hell out. Think back and hate it and wish I'd done more, except call the stupid cops who didn't do a damn thing. But I didn't outnumber the robbers. I was outnumbered. Although later, nah, I shouldn't even say this because someone's going to quote me later and I'm going to wish I hadn't said that part. In any case, I was outnumbered. You could read about it on my blog. I didn't come in there 10 to 1 outnumbering the robbers and then stand there and do nothing. And that's basically what happened at this conference in Florida. And so, you know, really the question here is not just, you know, what's happened to our government that it's gotten so far out of control. It's what happened to us that we're willing to let it. What's happened to our society that we are willing to abandon liberty for what even? I mean, there used to actually be arguments for, well, you know, it's a matter of liberty versus convenience. It's a matter of liberty versus security. It's a matter of liberty versus this and versus that, but now, no, it's just the state versus liberty for its own sake. That's all it is now. I mean, security? That's security? A bunch of thugs coming up and electrocuting you? Bombing Iraq and killing a million people? That's security? Bombing. Invading and bombing over and over and over and over again and then invading again. That's security? We're sacrificing our liberty for that? It seems like, no, it's just being sacrificed because, you know, the people with the power like being the guy with the knife. I don't think anybody would argue that we're getting a bunch of security out of this. Well, maybe they would. I don't think they'd argue it to me, though. All right, well, let's see here. I guess I need to find something else to talk about. You know what's really important to talk about? Dr. Ron Paul. You have no idea how enthusiastic I am about the Ron Paul campaign for presidency. And you know what? I don't know what kind of chance he has. And I'm tired of making predictions, and I'm tired of doomsaying or, you know, predicting great possibilities or any of that. I just don't know what's going to happen. It could be that there's a good 40% of the people in this country who say, wait a minute. Did that guy just say end the war and restore the Bill of Rights? That's it. Got my vote. Could be. It could be that we topped out at 4%. And we're the ones who care about liberty. I just don't know. But I do know that even if it turns out that all these Ron Paul revolutionaries really were just a bunch of Ron Paulians in waiting all along anyway, and that nobody's really being converted here, it's still exciting just to have the opportunity to have someone who really is a libertarian, really is an individualist, up there on the stage with the worst power monger, bloody-handed liars in this country. as they lie and lie and lie, as they pander to the red state fascist base of the Republican Party, all that remains. He stands up there and he says the truth and he doesn't back down. And he's a nice old guy too. It's funny how so many articles describe how thin he is or whatever. He's a bigger guy than me, I think, actually, but he is. He's a nice old grandpa. He's not an imposing presence whatsoever. Yeah, and in fact, unlike George Bush, he's got a firm Texas handshake, too. Looks you right in the eye. And with the real smile. Not one of them fake ones that the bloody-handed liars like to, act out. Anyway, I'm stoked about Ron Paul. He's right about, well, the following issues. Monetary policy, the imperial presidency, the imperial domination of the world by that imperial presidency. He wants to restore every bit of the Bill of Rights. He wants to get us out of the United Nations, not because they're in the way of our aggression, but because they are the linchpin. They are the excuse to wage aggressive war and that it must come to an end. He wants to take all the powers that don't belong to him and give them back to the people, the states, the Congress, as required by the Constitution. And, I don't know. It's been said a million times. It sounds like hyperbole if you are lost in the woods and you don't really know what's going on. This probably won't sound right. Maybe you need to do a little bit more research to understand what I mean when I say Ron Paul's our last chance to have a republic. That's it. And hell, maybe that is just hyperbole because there never was a republic. It's always been an empire. But, clearly now we've already taken the fork in the road of choosing empire and ruin over the rule of law, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. We've already taken the wrong path. And now the argument is whether we ought to let Ron Paul drive for a while and see if maybe he can defy that empire ahead, no U-turns sign, and see if he could get back to a place. Not back in time, but back to a situation in which the president is not the elected dictator of America, which is basically what we have now. And if you doubt that, because you don't see tanks on your streets and you don't see people being rounded up and thrown into camps and so forth, you just need to take a little bit of time to examine the law, to examine the precedent set. Now, Bill Clinton was an imperial president. I remember the Birchers did a great Photoshop that had Clinton all wearing the imperial purple robes and with his frumpy little hat with a feather in it and everything. We've had an imperial presidency for a long time. But here's what George Bush has done. George Bush has said, you know what? I don't have to obey the law at all. And in the circumstances where he said, okay, I'll obey the law, and has seemingly gone along with, say, for example, Supreme Court decisions, he adds a signing statement to the end that says, fingers crossed, I can still do whatever I want. And so far that has included secret prisons and torture and murder and aggressive war, the abduction of Americans and their detention by the U.S. military. The state secrets privilege thrown around all over the place to keep the truth from being investigated. And it is a revolution within the form. We've had an imperial president all along, but what we have now is an imperial president who's basically saying, look, I am the Senate. What? That's what I thought. That's where we're at now. And the only solution to that is to elect someone who doesn't want that much power. Or really, the power at all. Someone like Dr. Paul, who actually, honestly, perceives this as his responsibility to try to do the best he can in his life to preserve liberty for you and me, and, well, obviously, particularly his own kids and grandkids. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and, Dodd, Richardson. I won't denounce Gravel and Kucinich because I think they're decent gentlemen. These Democrats want unlimited power for themselves. They don't want to end the war. They have the votes to end the war right now. They don't want to end the war. They don't want to end the torture in the secret prisons. They want that power for themselves. Rudy Giuliani, John McCain, and Fred Thompson, and Mitt Romney. They want that power for themselves so that they can torture people, so that they can murder people, so that they can start aggressive wars, so that they can pretend like the Bill of Rights is nothing but a goddamn piece of paper rather than a list of ironclad restrictions on their authority. That's what they want. Well, guess what? There's one person running for president who's running simply, in his own words, and I believe every bit of it, to restore the republic. To protect the Bill of Rights. To end America's imperial foreign policy. And to save our country from economic ruin and totalitarianism. It's your last chance. We'll see if you take it. But if you think there's going to be, don't worry, because the next Ron Paul type will be running 4 years from now. Don't worry, the next Ron Paul type will be running 4 years after that. You're fooling yourself. What Ron Paul type? There's one in the House of Representatives now, him. Name a governor, name a senator, name anyone with any political influence anywhere that believes and behaves like Ron Paul does. This is your last chance, and what's hilarious is I'm pretty sure you're not going to take it. But it sure is nice to see all the people rallying to his cause and trying to help him win. And on a personal note, I'm very grateful. And I think all of us owe Dr. Paul a lot of thanks for putting himself through this in order to get the message of liberty out. He's a hell of a guy. Hey, listen, what you're about to hear is Ron Paul mad or under fire. What you're about to hear is Ron Paul at the Value Voters debate. This is his concluding comments. And the people in the audience are the Jerry Falwell crowd of Republican voters. They are the red state fascists. They are the kooks. They are the dead enders. The last useful idiots of the war party in this country. And while every other Republican panders to them and denounces the Mexicans and denounces the Arabs and vows eternal warfare, vows that the national government should use every bit of its violence-enforcing authority to make people moral and good and better, to make them stop getting divorced, to make them, stop having abortions, to make them believe in Jesus. And this is Ron Paul, as close as he will ever get, my friends, to pandering politically for power. Thanks for listening today. Oh, see, I hit a glitch because I didn't have my volume up and ready to go. So there you go. I couldn't possibly end the show right. Sorry. Anti-War Radio, Chaos, 95.9 in Austin.
Well, you have 4 minutes for your closing statement.
Thank you. We have been blessed to be able to live in the greatest country in the world. We've had the best contract between the people and the government, but we're losing it, and we have to realize that. We have resorted to going to Washington for everything. We cannot go to Washington to dictate to us how we improve our personal behavior. You don't dictate, you don't legislate virtue. In a free society, you do that from the people, from your family, your friends, and your neighbors, but not in the federal government. Also, you can't legislate economic fairness like so many want to do. Freedom means freedom. It means the government should be very small. Also, although we have many good qualities, if you accept the principle that we can promote our qualities and force them on other people at risk, you're in big trouble, because there is a true phenomenon called blowback, and people don't like to have their countries occupied, and they will resent it, and we will suffer the consequences from this. In the last several years, we as a party and as a country, we have suffered because the conservative movement has been taken over by the neoconservatives, and they're not conservatives at all. They don't believe in limited government. They believe in entitlements. They also believe in the Woodrow Wilson's philosophy of making the world safe for democracy, run around the world and forcing ourselves and bankrupting this country. We're spending nearly $1 trillion a year overseas, and this country's in bad shape financially. So we need to decide what we're going to do. Are we going to live within the law, or are we going to pretend the government can take care of everything possible? We are now $9 trillion in debt. We have a dollar that's crashing, and we keep financing this by taxing, borrowing, and then what do we resort to? We resort to printing the money. We should look to the Constitution. We should make sure that we get rid of our central bank, the Federal Reserve, and have only gold and silver as legal tender. This is the reason our government gets so big, because we give them license to steal, license to inflate, license to tax, and license to borrow, and politicians will always do it. What we should struggle for is our freedom. Have faith and trust in freedom that it works. We've lost our faith and confidence in ourselves. We feel like we have to be the bullies of the world, and we feel like we have to have government in Washington. What happens when government fails in Washington? Going to go to the UN like we already have? We already obey the WTO. We changed tax laws because of the WTO. There's every reason in the world that if we just look to our traditions and understood our problems, we can once again set the goal for liberty, not for this perfect society that comes at the sacrifice of liberty. When you ask government to do it, you have to sacrifice liberty. This is not difficult to understand, but right now we are drifting rather rapidly into a totalitarian state. We have been too willing to sacrifice our liberties for this so-called sense of security. We need more faith in the Second Amendment. We need more faith that the right of habeas corpus should be protected. And we have to understand the national ID card is not going to work. That only registers and regulates the American people. And we don't need secret prisons. We don't need torture. We need American values and traditions. We need to believe in ourselves. And once again, I would like to reiterate from a Christian viewpoint, you know, the true doctrine of war written by Christianity, the doctrine of non-war, the just war, is that you do it only under certain circumstances. You don't do it for UN resolutions. You don't do it for weapons that don't exist. You need to do it with a moral justification. If we would have declared a war, like I insisted they should if they want to go to war, we wouldn't be debating the war now. It would be over, and we'd all be a lot better off, and we would have 5,000 Americans still alive and 30,000 uninjured.
Okay.
Greatest congressman ever.